Morning, Your Honors. My name is Carter Phillips. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, please be aware that the time showing is your total time remaining.
Yes, ma'am. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
I'd like to begin with the non-disclosure agreement, which I think candidly is the fundamental error that the district court committed. And that error completely shifted the entire focus of the proceedings and requires candidly a do-over in the circumstances of this case. The battle between the parties was whether or not my clients had used trade secrets or had breached the confidential agreement. And it's undisputed that the trade secrets derived completely from that confidential agreement. The agreement by its terms says, provided that this agreement shall terminate on the date 2 years from the date hereof. That language can only be read, in my estimation, and certainly the only way to read it under English law, is that that supersedes all of the other obligations that the contract provides for. And therefore, after the two-year period had expired, which was August of 2013, my clients were free to use all of the information that had been provided by Blade Room in any way that they so chose to use it.
May I interrupt, however, please?
Yes, of course, Judge Murphy.
I agree that this is the seminal issue in the appeal that we have to decide first. And I understand your argument. To be fair, before the proviso, I think the question is, what I'd like to know is how we as an appellate court have to read this, because clearly I would just make the following observations. The introduction of the paragraph indicates that respective obligations under the agreement shall be continuing and survive the termination of the discussions for Emerson to purchase Blade Room. We all know, and I think what the district judge attempted to give credit to, is that there would be no point to a paragraph like this if the parties didn't want to keep trade secrets and other confidential information exchanged during the prospective sale secret forever. So I agree with you 100% that this proviso undermines what appears to be the overall thrust of the paragraph. And I agree that the plain words of the paragraph have to be construed, but the judge below seem to be wanting to reflect the reality of the parties when they negotiated this paragraph. Agree?
Well, there's no doubt that that's what the judge below thought that he was doing in the way he interpreted the contract. But that, of course, begs the question whether that's the appropriate role for a judge to take when you're talking about interpreting the language of the contract. It says what it says. These are sophisticated parties. This contract was written by Blade Room. So if they had wanted to make it absolutely clear that the obligations with regard to the confidential information that was being imparted would last for, you know, to retain that as confidential would remain in place in perpetuity, it would have been easy enough to do it. And indeed, even in this record, there is the exact same, not exact same, but a comparable agreement between Blade Room and Facebook that in fact does maintain the information in perpetuity. Now, Judge Murphy, I do think there is a narrower answer to your question, which is why would you logically do what they did in this particular instance? And it actually sort of takes two forms. One is, I mean, you would identify, I think, the surviving the termination of the discussions and negotiations, because that was really the reason the parties came together, right? There was a transaction in mind, and they wanted to make sure that even if one or both parties walked away from the transaction, that the obligations would remain in effect for some period of time. And then they identify precisely that period of time, which would be 2 years. But the other aspect of the case, and I don't know why the district judge didn't give it more credence, is the fact that both parties, or at least certainly Blade Room, would have known, and I think Emerson would have been comfortable with it as well, which is From our perspective, all of their real intellectual property was embodied in the patents. They had filed their application for a patent. Those patents were going to be disclosed some months later, but well within before the two-year period had run. And there was a serious question once those patents issued as to whether or not there would be anything to be to protect under the trade secret. So by saying that the whole thing goes away at the end of 2 years, effectively, I think Blade Room is simply giving up the sleeves off its vest because, as it turns out, the when it became public, the trade secret protections would have dissolved in any event.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, is there is there any evidence to point that that was the reason why Emberson crafted the agreement the way it did? I mean, it certainly makes a reasonable post hoc rationalization, but is there any evidence that was the intent or on their mind at the time?
Well, it's important to remember, Your Honor, that this is Blade Room who drafted this language.
I'm sorry. Yes, Blade Room. Sorry. Yeah.
And so, no, there's no direct evidence of that. I mean, the only evidence we have from Blade Room, which I think candidly shouldn't have been admitted in any event, was the subjective intent of the author of the contract, who said it was his view that these would last in perpetuity. But I don't think that's the legitimate way to think about it. I think the question is, the way the district judge looked at it, he said it would be sort of commercial irrationality to agree to a two-year, and what we're suggesting, it seems to me, if that's the judge's rationale, then the argument and response is that true? Is it a commercial irrationality when you know that the patent's going to be disclosed? And the answer then is no, of course not. It makes perfect commercial sense to draft it the way they did draft it. And given that it's not as though they didn't have access to language that would be comparable to this, because they had the Facebook model. They clearly chose this language and presumably chose it for a reason. We were comfortable with it. But that's the limit on the constraint on our ability to use the confidential information that Blade Room gave to us.
Counsel, under English law, was evidence of the subjective intention of the parties admissible to interpret the contract?
No, Your Honor, it shouldn't be. If the plain language of the contract, the written agreement, states it plainly, the subjective intent of the signers of the agreement, and particularly the one-sided subjective intent of the signers, is irrelevant and not admissible in court of law. And so that testimony shouldn't have been admitted. I don't think that's ultimately the important question for this case.
Mr. Phillips.
Because I don't think the court has to go beyond the plain language of the agreement.
Mr. Phillips. Blade Room argues, it seems to me, that there's really two, if I'm gathering this correctly, there's two separate agreements here. First of all, the confidentiality obligations continue, as stated in the first part of the paragraph, but that the negotiations and agreement itself terminate 2 years later. I think that's in the opening brief at page 28, roughly. Now, that's one way to read the plain language. But if we do, my personal position is that agreement A or sub A, if you will, and agreement sub B, if you will, cannot be read together. So then does that, under English law, as Judge Rawlinson noted, provide for extrinsic evidence on the intent of the parties?
But I don't think the premise of the question, Judge Murphy, is correct, because I think in this context, the particular language I would focus on actually is the words in particular. So the second clause is simply giving clarity to the first clause. It's a continuing obligation, and it's an obligation that continues in particular, right, even if the negotiations for the underlying transaction to give rise to this agreement should come to an end. They didn't want to just have the party split. And remember, there are a lot of obligations embedded in here. Most of them are non-disclosure agreements, but there's also poaching of employees. And so it's important to have those obligations continuing even after the negotiations have come to an end. And then the provided for proviso, it seems to me, modifies the entirety of it. And it's important because it's not confident. It's the respective obligations of the parties to is the opening portion of Section 12, and it is in the provided that this agreement shall terminate, meaning all of the respective obligations of the party should terminate. Did the district court
determine that this contract provision was ambiguous?
Well, I don't think so. I think the district court concluded that it would have been irrational, commercially irrational, for the party, for Blade Room to enter into an agreement like this, and therefore was unwilling to adopt that construction of it. I think actually the district court found the language plain and said that it supports precisely the position that Emerson put forward, and the judge then refused to enforce it as written, concluding that the parties would not have undertaken that agreement, and that's not only clearly not an appropriate role for the district court to play in a case. It wouldn't have been an appropriate role for a member of the UK court system to play either. That's just not how English contracts are interpreted. They're interpreted by their language, and particularly because Judge Rawlinson, even if the judge had decided that it was ambiguous, still true under English law that the ambiguity is construed to the detriment of the party who drafted it. And again, this is Blade Room's language, not Emerson's. And so they're the ones.
Isn't there also a canon in English commercial contract law interpretation that you look to commercial sense? How does that play into this with respect to the plain language?
Yeah, you look at the commercial sense, I think, when there's some ambiguity in terms of the understanding of the contract. If the language is not plain, one of the interpretive aids is there, UK law, just as in US law, is the nature of the transaction and the party's dealings and a variety of other considerations. But if the language of the contract is clear, then none of that is relevant either as a matter of UK law or US.
So your position is we don't even look to commercial sense or purpose of the contract to interpret it because the language is clear.
That's my number one position, is the language is clear and the court ought to interpret it. But if the court wanted to go beyond that and at least draw some comfort from whether this is something that no rational, if your fear was no rational entity would enter into an agreement like this, the reality is that the circumstances here make it perfectly rational for an entity to enter into an agreement just like this, because they knew that all of this information was going to be in the public domain in a period of time shorter than 2 years. And of course, they had certain obligations under this. So for their purposes, they were going to have those obligations ended after 2 years as well. I mean, it's a bilateral agreement, even though it was drafted by Blade Room and therefore.
Counsel, if we agree, go ahead, Judge
Murphy. No, you go ahead, Judge Bumate.
Just quickly, if we agreed with your interpretation, what should happen next? What should we do if we agreed with your interpretation of the contract?
You should vacate the judgment and remand for a new trial. And candidly, that trial would look vastly different than the trial we had in this particular case. Take off the table.
Wait just a minute. We can't just credit your interpretation of the contract and send it back. We could credit your interpretation of the contract, but then we have to figure out whether or not the judge's error precluded Emerson from offering the defense, and then whether or not the defense, if presented, would have made a difference in the trial, right?
Well, there is the question of harmless error.
Yeah, and we're in appellate court, and this was a 21-day trial with thousands of pieces of documentary evidence and dozens of witnesses. How do you propose we go through and do that?
Well, I think the easiest way to look at it is that not getting the non-disclosure agreement's obligations correct is the fundamental foundation and building block for the entirety of the trial. Because it makes a world of difference whether you're just talking about behavior that ends on August 2013 and the flow of activities. And remember, the damages here come from contracts entered into in 2014, a sale of a division of the company in 2016. That looks very different if you're saying that this all terminates in 2013 than it does if the obligate, if our obligations live on in perpetuity. So I don't think there is any way this court could infer from the way this case ultimately was tried and decided that it had anything other than a harmful effect, because we would have had a much, much stronger ability to say there is no causation in this case for the kinds of damages. You're talking about $77 million in damages flowing from, if we're right on the contract, conduct that after 2013 was completely permissible and that we could have relied on and arguing that nothing we did prior to the termination of this agreement could possibly have made any difference, given that we were free to use all of that information once the non-disclosure agreement had come to an end. So I think under any ordinary, I mean, the burden's on them to show that it's harmless. And it seems to me this is such a fundamental problem that there is no way, Judge Murphy, that the court could do anything other than to say it is a harmful error. It should go back for a new trial. And that trial will candidly look vastly different than the one that the court, than the trial that was held previous to that time. The problem I have is I don't see a clock, so I don't know how much time I have.
I was going to ask you, did you want to save any time for rebuttal? You had 3 minutes and 48 seconds.
Since I don't see a clock, yes, ma'am, I would prefer to save time for rebuttal other than just give me 30 seconds to say one thing. And I realize it's sort of cart before the horse, but I do think it's important that even if the court disagreed with me about every other argument, the one argument that is undeniably an error is the prejudgment interest in this particular. The October 2012 date is not a date that you can use for assigning pretrial interest, and it makes a huge difference in the overall numbers in this case. That I would rest.
Seems like the punitive damages are clearly erroneous as well for similar reasons and overstated because of that, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from Emerson Electric. Who's arguing? I mean, we'll hear from Blade Room. I'm sorry. Ms. Scaff?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Stephanie Scaff on behalf of the plaintiff Blade Room. I'll start immediately with the NDA issue because that's the issue that obviously is in front of the court most primary here. The district court's interpretation of the NDA was correct, but in any event, even if that interpretation was erroneous, it did not affect the verdict outcome or the judgment here. I'll start with the interpretation itself. In interpreting a contract, Ingress Law looks not only to the words used, but also to the purpose and the whole of the agreement. Here, the interpretation was not only supported by Section 12 of the agreement, but also an objectively reasonable reading of the NDA as a whole. This agreement was about discussions for an acquisition. It was not about giving Emerson rights to use this information to compete with Blade Room. In fact, that was completely not intended by this agreement.
But counsel, do we look at the intention of the parties or do we look at the plain language of the agreement?
So, Your Honor, we look at a reasonable objective intention of the parties in entering the agreement.
What case from England says that we look at the reasonable intention of the parties?
So it's the objective reasonable reading of the contract, and that's the Chitty, which in England, the Chitty on contracts is kind of the basic law of how you review a contract.
But the cases talk about the plain reading of the contract. And so if the plain wording of the contract says one thing, are you saying that we can say a different thing by looking at the objective intent of the parties?
The cases support the reading, not just of the specific language of the section, but of the whole contract as a whole. And that's what the English courts look to. And that is consistent in all of the cases, including the cases that Emerson cites.
But what other language in the contract would support a reading other than the fact that the NDA terminates in 2 years?
So paragraph 2B and 2C expressly prevent disclosure of confidential information at any time. And paragraph 2H says that
that's very general language. And in the NDA, there's specific language. So specific language controls over general language.
Yeah, and I would also note for the court that there is specific language limiting some obligations. Mr. Phillips referred to the solicitation obligation. That obligation, there's express language saying that ends in 18 months. So when the parties wanted to end an obligation in a specific time, they knew how to do it, and they did it.
That's what the contract says about the non-disclosure, a specific time.
No, the non-disclosure agreement is always referred to as at any time. The only thing that says it's terminated is the agreement itself. So in other words, the first part of Section 12 uses the word obligation. The second part of the phrase uses the term agreement. And that's very different than, for example, the Brunel case and the Swiss Bank case, where both sections, both the section before the provided then and the section after the provided then, use the exact same language.
So in Counsel, Brunel, are you arguing that the non-disclosure agreement never ended?
No, the non-disclosure agreement itself terminated in August of 2013. But the confidentiality obligation as to any information that it was exchanged during the time that the agreement was in effect, that information was required to be continuing to be kept confidential by Emerson.
For how long?
I'm not sure if that makes sense, does it? You can't say that a non-disclosure agreement ended, but its obligations to keep things quiet persisted. That just doesn't make sense.
That's actually very consistent with what the English courts have ruled, and they even rule that as an implied
what
obligation.
English court has ever found a non-disclosure agreement or a confidentiality agreement to end and the information subject to it to be kept secret?
That's the personal hygiene case. It's at Appendix A47, and I would direct the court specifically to paragraph 36 of that decision. And there the court concludes that even if the NDA language of that agreement was unclear as to the continuing confidentiality obligation, that English law will imply continuing obligation of confidentiality when the party receives the confidential information.
But that's in the absence of direct language like you have here, which terminates the agreement. There's no such strong language in that case that you see here.
That agreement also terminated, and the obligation the court found continued. Again, I think the bigger issue for this court in determining this is that even if the district court's decision on this issue was incorrect, which we don't believe it was very consistent with a reasonable interpretation of this contract. The reality is that the confidentiality obligation, as well as all of the other obligations of this contract, continued until August of 2013. Even under Emerson's interpretation of this contract. And the evidence was that Emerson repeatedly breached the contract by improperly disclosing and using the information in the period June 2012 to October 2012. And during that time, the agreement was still in effect. So the question for this court is—
I thought Emerson's position was that they considered and were aware of the confidential information, but did not use it in any way, shape, or form in this litigation until after August of 2013. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. Their argument is that they could have used this information after August of 2013 because they had a right to do it then, but that's irrelevant. What they did do and what the evidence showed was that they obtained the information in June of 2012, and then they repeatedly disclosed and used that information over the course of that summer and the early fall 2012 and to come up with a competing design that they presented to Facebook in October of 2012.
Outside of their own company deliberations, they disclosed the information?
Absolutely. And not only did they disclose it to Facebook, they also disclosed it outside of the acquisition team. And the contract expressly says that they cannot disclose it only to people with a need to know for purposes of the acquisition.
And the counsel, is this the way the evidence was presented during the trial, though?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And that evidence is in our brief, and I can give you the citations to that, all of that information. It's at page 10 through 16 of our brief, the improper acquisition disclosure and use. That's all in 2012, as well as the presentation to Lulia, to Facebook of the stolen design. That's on October 30th, 2012. And that was also part of the evidence in front of the court.
Was there any evidence of improper use after August 13th?
So what happened after October 13th was simply the additional consequential damages. In other words, they had already won the contract. They had already gotten the design in, which all of the witnesses testified that the design was the key. Even Emerson's own witnesses, Mr. Pouchet, the design was the key to them obtaining Lulia instead of Blade Room. And Facebook said the same, witnesses said the same thing. The only thing that happened after that was they went and they actually signed the formal contract.
It's your position here today that the non-disclosure agreement was breached during the time that the contract was in effect?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And so at trial, you didn't rely on any actions taken after the contract terminated. Is that your position today?
That is correct.
That's the position you took at trial as well?
That is correct. Our theory was that the contract breach had happened in 2012, that the damage was done on October 30th, 2012, when Emerson presented its stolen design to Facebook and received approval for the Lulia project.
Counsel, do you want us to go through and make sure that happens, or would it be better to remand to the district court to find out if this was a harmless error?
So I think that your honors can see that finding in the district court's decisions themselves. So the district court repeatedly references the October 30th, 2012 date, not only in connection with the prejudgment interest ruling, but also in connection with its ruling, its findings of fact in the UCL claim, findings of fact and conclusions of law order, and also in reference to the Rule 50 motion. So it is...
Well, the difficulty I'm having with that concept is that the district court said it was really difficult to apportion the damages between the non-disclosure agreement and the trade secrets misappropriation. So I'm not sure the district court was as pristine in its reasoning as you are being here today.
So the difficulty in apportioning between the trade secret and the contract claim is because the damages between the two were fungible. In other words, the same amounts were of damages flowed from the breach of contract that flowed from the trade secret misappropriation.
Not true. That's not true. Because some of the damages were profits, right?
So the
profits would flow from the breach of the non-disclosure agreement?
That's right. That's correct, Your Honor. Under English law, and the district court made this specific ruling at trial on the unjust enrichment under the contract. Emerson has not appealed that ruling to this court. And that was a ruling made by the district court in connection.
Well, I think there was an appeal regarding the apportionment of the damages. And so for the damages to be apportioned, there would have to be some type of segmenting of what part of the harm is attributable to the non-disclosure agreement breach and what part of the harm is attributable to the misappropriation of the trade secrets. Necessarily.
Again, both the contract and the trade secret misappropriation allowed both for lost profits as well as unjust enrichment.
But certain damages are not available for the non-disclosure agreement that would be available for the misappropriation of the trade secrets, like exemplary damages, for instance.
So the exemplary damages, right. So in terms of the punitive damages, what the Pasatino case says is that when you have a general damages verdict, like you have here, in other words, it's not split out between the two claims, that what the district court has the discretion to award all of the compensatory damages that the jury found, as well as to award punitive damages if the conduct is conduct that supports the punitive damages. Here, the jury made that specific predicate finding on the actual verdict. So the court was correct. In other words, what Pasatino says is that the court not only has discretion to do that that award, but it actually has an obligation to make sure that the intent of the jury's verdict is preserved. And here, the intent of the jury's verdict was not only to award compensatory damages, whether that be for contract or for trade secret, but also to award punitive damages. And
exemplary damages are not available for a particular cause of action, the jury cannot award damages for that.
The jury can't award, but again, the trade secret claim here is what carried the punitive damages award. And the trade secret claim is not affected by the decision on the NDA.
Was the award apportioned though? How do we know how much of the award was based on the trade secrets and how much was based on the NDA? How do we know that?
So again, that's the Pasatino decision, 212 F3rd 493. In that decision, what this court said was that when you're faced with a general damages verdict that does not apportion between claims, that the district court has broad discretion in determining the amount of punitive damages if one of the claims has the right to award punitive damages. And that's exactly the case here. So, and again, the court went on to say that not only does it have that discretion, it has the obligation to do that because that's what preserves the jury's intent on the verdict. And in this case in particular, the jury was instructed on punitive damages for willful and malicious misappropriation.
Did you cite this in your brief?
This was in the supplemental submission that we submitted to the court. We submitted two cases. One was Pasatino, which had to do with general...
When was that case decided?
That case was decided by the Ninth Circuit in 2000.
And well, why was it a supplemental? If that's pivotal to your argument, why was it done in a supplemental brief as opposed to in your main brief?
Because that decision, so we took the position in our brief that the review was for abuse of discretion. And when Emerson replied, they said, no, it's de novo because it's an issue of law of whether or not the court could do this. And that's what Pasatino was referring to. And they also argued that somehow the discretion in the reply brief, that the discretion that the court exercised in the punitive damages context somehow conflicted with what the district court judge did in the offset context. And that is also not correct. The district court had the discretion to act on the jury's verdict and to preserve what that verdict intended, which was both compensatory damages and, because of the malicious finding, a punitive damages award. In the offset context, the burden was on Emerson to prove a right to an offset. And in that context, the district court...
Can I interrupt briefly?
Sure.
Because my recollection of one of the aspects of this particular issue is that the district court had determined in its order denying the motion to compel the Facebook settlement that it couldn't apportion the misappropriation of the NDA damages. So it would seem that Judge Rawlinson is right, that the court had made that decision well before it got to the point of the jury verdict.
That decision came after the jury award. So that came after, that was one of the last motions that the court ruled on. And that decision, what the judge said is that you can't tell from the verdict what amount was awarded. And that is correct. Plaintiff, Blaver, we actually asked for a differentiated verdict that would have allowed that difference. And Emerson objected to that and proposed one that was general, which the court ended up giving along with the deduplication instruction. The difference is the procedural context. So in the punitive damages context, what the Pasatino case says is that there, the court had discretion to look beyond the verdict to the evidence to see whether the evidence supported the award on either of the claims. And if so, if it supported the punitive damages, if there was a finding, and there was here on the verdict of malicious conduct, that it should go on to award punitive damages.
And counsel, what's the citation for the Pasatino case?
It's 212 F3rd 493. In the offset context, by contrast, as the district court correctly found, it was Emerson's burden to show a right to offset from the award. The jury's verdict indicates no intent to give Emerson an offset. And in fact, the offset statute is really this quid pro quo, right? The Emerson's obligations of contribution to a settling defendant, here Facebook, are extinguished, and in turn, Emerson gets an offset. There has been no good faith order or motion by Facebook. There never was. Emerson's rights to contribution have never been extinguished. And what the Conrad case says, and that's the other case that we submitted in our supplement, it says the same thing that the Textron case that the district court relied on says, which is that it's Emerson's burden to show a right to offset from the award. But Conrad actually goes one step further and says not only is it its burden, but when a party doesn't propose a differentiated verdict that allows the court to determine between the two claims, one which is subject to offset and one which is not, then they waive the right to claim the offset. And here, that's exactly what happened. The tort claim carried a right to offset. The contract claim did not. And Emerson proposed a verdict that didn't differentiate between the two. And basically, what Emerson is trying to do is hold this general verdict against Blaterum in the punitive damages context, where we actually asked for it to be separated, and also to take advantage of it in the offset context where the
counsel, but that's because that was the way the court phrased the instruction. So I'm on the Pasatino case, and this is a Title VII case. We noted that the claims were basically the same. The reasoning that you gave us regarding this case doesn't apply when the claims are different, because in this case, the punitive damages could be tacked on to either of the claims because they were the same. And so apportionment was not necessary. We don't have that here. The claims are not the same in this case.
In Pasatino, actually, only one of the claims had a right to punitive damages. The other one, the state law claim, did not.
Right. And so we said the claims were essentially the same. They were both discrimination claims, one under federal law, one under state law. So it didn't matter whether or not it was apportioned, because basically it was the same wrong. We don't have that here. We have two different claims. They're not the same claim. So the reasoning in Pasatino does not transfer to two different claims.
So the conduct here, that it was exactly the same conduct that underlied.
But it wasn't the same claim. And that's what we said in Pasatino. It's the exact same claim, one under the federal law and one under the state analog. We don't have that here. We don't have a trade secrets claim under federal law and under state law, or non-disclosure agreement under federal law and state law. We have two distinct and separate claims here.
I think that's correct to what you've said, Judge Rawlinson. I would just point out that what the court looked at there was whether or not the damages between the two claims were effectively fungible. That was the court looked at
whether or not the claims were the same.
And it also looked at whether the claims were the same and the conduct was the same. Emerson suggests that there is different conduct here, but that's actually not correct. The conduct is exactly the same. The only difference is that under the contract, it was a breach of contract of a confidentiality obligation when they used and disclosed the trade secret information. And under the trade secret law, it was a improper use and disclosure of trade secret.
The breach is complete when the trade secret is disclosed, but the misappropriation is not complete until they actually used the information. So it's not the exact same conduct.
So the trade secret statute provides for two separate types of misappropriation. One is use and one is misappropriation. One is disclosure. You don't need both of those. Either are sufficient to support a trade
secret.
That's
not how this case was tried, though.
Both happened here, and the district court in its Rule 50 order specifically ruled that the disclosure was independently sufficient to support the trade secret verdict. And the evidence was that is exactly what happened, that they both disclosed and used. So they disclosed the information in a way that they were not permitted to, including by disclosing it to their design and engineering team who was competing with Blade Room. And they also used it and disclosing it to Facebook. They met repeatedly with Facebook over three months, disclosing and using the information to try to come up with their copycat design. And then ultimately, they again disclosed the final version of it in their presentation.
Would you object to a remand for the district court to sort all this out? Because the district court sat through the trial and would be in a much better position to make this determination than we are.
On the punitive damages issue?
On the allocation, whether or not if any error was harmless on the NDA. Would you object to us remanding that to the district court for a fresh look if we determine that the non-disclosure agreement ruling was error?
I think, Your Honor, that is something that can be done. I would just say that the district court did make these rulings, particularly on the allocation of the damages in its actual decision.
It didn't make the ruling in the context of if we decide that the ruling on the non-disclosure agreement was error, then the district court could decide whether or not it was harmless error or what relief, if any, should be granted.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that the district court could do that, and I'm confident that the district court would do it in a way that was consistent with it.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try to be brief. First of all, with respect to the contract as a whole, Chitty is quite clear how you read these agreements. You asked the question about whether or not subjective intent can count. And Chitty on page 1040, section 13-048, it says courts are not concerned to identify the subjective understandings of the parties to the contract or the meaning which they subjectively ascribe to the term in dispute. Such evidence is therefore inadmissible. If you look at
unless there's certain circumstances, which I frankly don't think we have here. There has to be special reasons. Chitty would allow you to look at the intent, but nothing.
Typically, you're supposed to look at the plain language of the statute. I think it's important, even if you're going beyond section 12, but even in section 2A, which is really the primary basis on which they make it, you'll notice that one doesn't say that the obligation runs forever. It doesn't have any time limitation at all. So for the use of the information, 2A would undeniably take you to section 12, and that without question then ends up being that it ends in August of 2013.
What about all these allegations of breach during the period prior to August of 13? I didn't get the sense that Emerson was willy-nilly breaching the non-disclosure agreement even before its termed expiration.
Well, obviously, our view of the world is that we didn't, but they certainly put, there's no question, they put on evidence that there was some potential use of that information as we were preparing our designs. I don't dispute that. What I do dispute, that my friend argued, is that somehow everything in their evidence stopped in August of 2013. The reality is that all of their damages flow from conduct that took place after 2013. There is a lot of discussion in the record post 2013, August 2013. It talks about marketing materials that my clients used. There are other projects where we allegedly used it, but all post-date that. And all of that evidence was free for the jury to consider because the jury was not told that we are free to go forward. And that takes me, Judge Rawlinson, to your question as to who should decide this. And the answer is you should decide as a matter of law today that this is not harmless error. This is a fundamental predicate to how this entire case is considered. And if you don't have the NDA right, the rest of the case cannot be just, you can't unscramble the egg at that point in time. With respect to punitives versus the punitive damages as they arise out of the trade secret versus the breach of contract, there is no way to reconcile the jury's verdict specifically saying that the trade secret nine, punitive trade secret nine, is not in fact a trade secret, but was in fact used. That's a contract claim. And so obviously the jury saw a difference between the contract and the trade secrets, and therefore not having any idea how much of the money was attributed to the trade secrets means that that part of the verdict has to be set aside. Judge Rawlinson, you distinguished the case that they cite in the 28J letter, candidly, better than I could. And so, as I say, it seems to me that this is not an issue that you remand to the district judge to determine harmless error. This is one where the presumption is on them to demonstrate that it was harmless. They cannot meet that burden in a case that was tried the way this case was tried, and where all of the damages flow from behavior, from actions ultimately taken 2 and 4 years after this agreement was terminated. So therefore, you should vacate and remand for a new trial under these circumstances. So no further questions. I appreciate
it. It appears not. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court.